6. Yet another fraudulent marriage. Octavia laughed as Modo stumbled under the weight of her luggage, bumping the guardrails of the gangplank. He regained his balance, and they boarded the SS Ottawa.
"Serves you right, silly man," she thought, "not allowing me to carry even one piece."
She held the second-class tickets in her hand, wondering if such a lowly fare was a sign that Mr. Socrates was becoming a miser. Or perhaps he wanted to teach them some lesson or other. But at least it wasn't steerage. Those poor people travelled like cattle. Octavia and Modo were led by a gruff steward to a cabin near the aft stairwell. Inside was a bed, a minuscule writing table, and, Octavia noted with satisfaction, a tiny water closet. They wouldn't have to use the public toilets.
"Well, husband, we've been in worse digs than this," she said as Modo closed the door.
"It'll do," he answered. "It needs airing." He went to the porthole and opened the window. He was wearing the doctor's face, that is how she referred to it, one of only a few he had shown her. She found it familiar and distant at the same time. His real face, the disfigured one, still burned in her memory.
"Are you enjoying our second fraudulent marriage?" she asked.
"One marriage to you was enough. A second is a trip into Dante's Inferno." She didn't like his tone, and didn't know what he meant by Dante, though the Inferno reference she assumed to be something hellish.
"Oh, you will feel the Inferno," she promised. "I was far too kind as a wife last time, hiring a drunk captain and scouring the Atlantic as you drifted to certain death in a diving bell."
"I'm sorry, Tavia," he said. "I was just trying to be clever. It's true, I owe you my life for finding me adrift on the ocean."
"You owe me thrice over, by my count. And last night you were going to leave without me. How do you know that?"
"I heard your exchange with Tharper."
"Don't you ever stop spying?" "My window was open. It's not my fault I have such good ears."
He sighed. "Truth is, I didn't think it likely that you'd go with me. After all, you don't speak French."
"Au contraire, je suis le tout."
"You just said I am a muddlehead."
"I did not. Tu es le muddlehead."
She grinned. Modo smiled his handsome doctor smile, and they both laughed.
"Modo," she said when they had caught their breath again, "why don't we watch our departure from the deck? The air would be good for us and our humours.
Then let us go, dear wife." He offered his arm and she took it, surprised that he held it all the way up the stairs as though they really were married. As second-class passengers, they still had access to the promenade, and they watched as the Ottawa left the dock bound for Liverpool. From there they would board another steamship and land in Le Havre. It was the quickest route from Montreal to Paris, for there were no direct steamships. Octavia was sad to leave Montreal. For a small backwater city, it had heart, the Scots, the Irish, even a few English, all working for a new life in a new land. And the Canadian French were so different from the French in France, rougher around the edges and more likely to swear. Of course, she based her judgments of the French on that tart, Colette, whom she'd met in Iceland. All morning, despite the cold, they read on their deck chairs huddled under blankets, and for lunch they had chicken sandwiches in the second-class saloon. After their meal, Modo withdrew his handkerchief and wiped his forehead, saying, "I must return to the cabin." Octavia knew what this meant. He could no longer maintain the visage and shape of the doctor. These transformations could only be held for a few hours at a time.
"I'll wait here," she said. "I'd like to visit the ladies' saloon. Perhaps there'll be some action there. You know, needlework, gossip, and penning morose diary entries."
He managed to smile and bowed, grimacing briefly, then turned abruptly. She recognized the sweat on his brow, the look of pain. That was it. It actually hurt for him to change. And she wondered at his lifetime of changing, of learning to be a chameleon. How much did it hurt him? He had spent so many hours manipulating his bones, his very flesh, all for the service of Mr. Socrates and Britain. He had once revealed his true appearance to her, but had not done so since. She preferred that. It had taken all of her willpower to look him in the eyes in the Australian rainforest. She hoped she would be able to do it again, but didn't want to be tested yet.
She spent a few hours reading Pride and Prejudice as other women played the small cottage piano. Later, arriving back at the cabin, she opened the door slowly. Modo was seated by the porthole, wearing his mask. His shoulders and back, so perfectly proportional when he played the doctor, now looked lumpy and malformed. He was staring out at the ocean.
"I have returned, husband," she said jauntily.
Modo nodded. Without taking his eyes off the water, he said, "If you had the chance to see your parents again, would you?"
"No,"
she answered without hesitation. She sat on the end of the bed.
"I'm not as sentimental as you, Modo. Remember, they left me at the orphanage with a note saying, 'Burden.'
Do you think I'm a fool for travelling all this distance to attempt to save my parents from this mysterious threat?
I'd expect nothing less of you. You're far more noble than me."
He laughed.
"I can't tell if you're serious."
"I am. And there's always the chance that you have brothers or sisters.
That's the one thing I wish to know, whether or not I had a sister or a brother. You know, someone as clever and quick and handsome as me."
"If it be, so then watch out, world." He smiled, then became serious.
"It's good to have you along, Tavia. It feels... well, there's no one else I'd rather share this journey with."
"You're not going all maudlin on me, are you, husband?"
"Never."
"Then, good. I suggest we dine on the upper deck tonight. As you know, I can eat more than 10 men. I plan on making those piano-playing ladies roll their eyes."